Tom Fortino joins us regularly on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You hear him Sundays as well from the Alpha Wealth Group. Tom, so what's with the market today?
Well, today is a good day, but, you know, one day does not a trend make, but it is a good day, so we will take it. I just will say that.
I've been waiting for, you know, given what's happened in the last couple of months, I keep thinking at some point we're going to have one of these Zoom days where people decide to start buying. That hasn't happened yet, really, has it?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, you look at it, it's more of a trend. You know, you kind of have what sometimes we would refer to as a head fake, right? I mean, the market goes up, you think, okay, this is it, we're going to get in. But you really need to see some support. You need to see, you know, if you're looking at it from a technical analysis, you know, a lot of these people will look at charts. You know, you'll take a look at certain levels of breaking through resistance, or is it going to cross over the 50-day, cross over the 200-day moving average? Are there things or trends that say, yeah, I think we've got some support, or this has got legs? We haven't seen that, right?
Well, and I suppose this idea that somebody might be buying the dip now forgets the fact that it's more than just an off day and people jump in. There's larger trends here, and the question is, when do those things start to turn around? I guess I'm thinking about inflation. Let's start there, Tom. What's your midterm forecast? How long do you think this bad run's going to run?
Well, I mean, there's still some clouds out there. You know, beyond the inflation, I know maybe you're saying, are we getting to that point where we're at peak inflation? I mean, the short answer to a lot of these things is nobody knows, right? You try to look at some of these numbers, but I think my concern is not just the inflation and you know, the Fed has come out and said, we're going to do the 50 basis points over the next three meetings. Okay. And that may change too, as we say, things can change, but then you have to take a look at, you know, we're talking about these food shortages, agricultural, they're talking about maybe 20% less yield because the fertilizers are down and all the costs that are there. We've got geopolitical issues. So there's just a lot of issues that are still kind of there. And I don't know if they're going away anytime soon. And so we're going to see, you know, earnings have been coming out. Some came out this week. You know, Costco is going to be after the bell. We had some good earnings this morning. Last week was bad. But I just, when you're saying, you know, kind of on one hand, but the other hand, there's just a lot of, I think there's a lot of things out there that could be some serious headwinds, certainly over the short term.
I'm going to wrap this up now and then advise people to listen to you on Sunday morning with Elise Glink at 6:30. But what's the last piece of wisdom you have for us on this day, Tom? The markets, the Dow is up 600 points, but what's your lasting thought today?
Well, it always is, you know, know your numbers, know where you stand. I mean, maybe you create some watch lists because this market will eventually turn. Maybe there's some stocks you want to purchase. Take a look at them. But get involved and take a look and make sure that you're protecting what you've worked so hard to create.
Yeah. Well, that's not the first time you've said something like that, but it probably is good advice because even when the market hadn't been tumbling, you said, what's your 401k in? What kind of investment scheme do you have? Do you know? And I said, I don't know that I do. And you said, well, you should know. And that was when things were relatively good. If things are in a tumble, all the more reason to at least pay attention to where your money is and what the plan for it is. That's Tom Fortino, the principal at Alpha Wealth Group, co-host of This Week in Wealth with Elise Glink, WGN Radio, Sundays at 6:30 a.m. Okay, Tommy, we'll listen to you later on. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot, John. You take care.
From CNET, Joan Salzman joins us to catch us up on the tech world and, for that matter, our daily Elon Musk update. Hi, Joan. How are you?
Hi, John. It's always great to join you.
Likewise. I just mentioned that, and you and I kind of have each week been following his exploits. Has it been a quiet week on the Elon Musk front? Not really. I mean, the fact that he might not be buying Twitter is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, that I feel like that was last week's update. This week's update is now a reversal of that. And he had a filing earlier this week. You know, after he made this tweet that the deal is, he characterized it as being on hold. Now there's a filing that seemingly renews his commitment to him, saying that he has more equity financing in the deal than he had previously. So There you go. Your weekly Elon Musk Twitter update.
Talk to me about hate speech on these kinds of platforms. What's the latest on that front?
Well, just this morning, a group of civil rights groups and advocacy groups issued a so-called list of demands for social networks to address hate speech on their platforms. They're calling for things like banning repeat offenders, going so far as Fox News host Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, taking down content based about this baseless so-called great replacement theory, applying their policies consistently, improving their algorithms to identify white supremacist speech. This is certainly, you know, the latest in a drumbeat of calls for social media companies to combat these things. And, you know, it's always sort of in this chamber where at the other end of the hall, there are calls for greater speech freedom on these platforms.
It's kind of hard, though. I mean, I understand what should be maybe taken down from a site, but then is the fact that you hate Tucker Carlson and Tucker Carlson is speaking, does that therefore make what he's saying hate speech? Of course it doesn't. So then how do you decide when a Tucker Carlson crosses the line? What is it that he said that is, you know, either so right. so dangerous to society that you have to pull it off? I don't think that's an easy call, do you?
Not easy, and nobody knows this better than the tech platforms that are trying to litigate these things. What's frustrating for, I think, groups like these that have, you know, come together to issue this call on social networks to do more, is that even though all of these social media platforms, they have community guidelines and they have rules around many things, including hate speech. But what is frustrating for people who are victims of hate speech and even people who would like greater freedom of speech on these platforms is that the enforcement of these guidelines is so opaque. So we can't, so even if we know that, for example, YouTube has specific rules around hate speech, it's not like we can see the, you know, so to speak, the case law of how they enforce it. We can't see what decisions they have made in the past. They don't, we can't see exactly how they're enforcing it right now and what they're doing. That's, we can't trace it over time. And so the question that you asked, there's a simple answer to it. You know, when do we know if Tucker Carlson has crossed the line of hate speech? It's when it comes down, when he gets banned. It's not knowing necessarily what he said or what he could say that could reach that. It's just we know when it happens because he's banned. And that's, at this point, kind of the best that we know.
One last thing. I'm not familiar with text-to-image artificial technology. What is that all about?
Yeah, this is actually a much lighter story, more fun to talk about. Text-to-image is this, it's any kind of programming language. It's usually based on an artificial intelligence. It takes text instructions, like if I were to type into this program, a cute corgi in a house made of sushi, and then it outputs an actual image that shows a cute corgi in a house made of sushi. That's what it is. Google has a new one that they say is even better than anything else that's ever happened before.
So I can do that now on Google, type in something like that? I guess I could, but so that's text-to-image. Well, in other words, I'm sorry, so if you can type anything or say anything into your Google browser, and then it will take you to stories about that, but you're talking about images, right?
Right, yeah, so this isn't something that's integrated in Google search, at least not as of yet. It's part of the part of Google Research, Google Brain, that explores different kinds of AI and advancing different kinds of machine learning. And so they've created a system, they call it Imogen, that does exactly that sort of thing. There's lots of examples, and they show the actual images that have output, like crazy things. Like I'm looking at now, it's like teddy bear swimming at the Olympics 400-meter butterfly event, and there's a teddy bear wearing a cap and goggles swimming across a pool. It's wild, the things that come out of it. But as of right now, nobody can go to Google and type in, I want to see, you know, a raccoon on a motorcycle and get an image of that.
But when that does happen, though, will it just pull up images that already exist, or is it somehow going to cobble together that image? It would do anything.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. The way that these sort of generative, they're called GANs, they're called Generative Adversarial Networks. And what they do is, simply as possible is they have gigantic sets of information about what something is supposed to look like, what things look like.
Yeah.
And it has two different computers essentially making one image and comparing it to the other one. And so the other one says that doesn't look right. And they kind of fight with each other back and forth until they come up with an image that these two different battling computers decide is actually close enough to what it should be. And that's where you get your raccoon
wow.
on a motorcycle.
Well, this is all really good news because I actually need an image of a cute corgi in a house made of sushi. So this is exactly what the world needs right now. And I'm glad that you told us about that today, Joan.
Exactly.
Joan Salzman is a senior reporter at CNET.com. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Joan.
Thanks. Bye.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman produces. This is John Williams. Jay Javers joins us now, founder at Midwest Property Group. This is an organization that's very involved in the commercial properties in the Midwest and West. You guys are located in Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about Chicago and the Midwest and how properties in the cities are doing, Jay. Thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me on. You know, I think from a kind of a macro standpoint, and not only in Chicago, but really across the country, it used to be the adage was location, location, location. Now I think it's product type, product type, product type. We've all read the stories of the industrial market across the country, but particularly in the Chicago area along the I-80 corridor is just they can't build the buildings fast enough because of the great road systems that we have here in the Chicago area. Apartments, obviously there's a big demand for that. And so that's a very strong sector. Hotels, unfortunately, are still struggling. And retail is really on a market-by-market basis. And the office building market is, it's you know, really trying to, people are really trying to determine how does work look like in 2022 to 2025.
When you say product type, you're talking about these different types of buildings or enterprises. For instance, along I-80, those are commercial warehouses. Is that what you're talking
right.
about there? Yeah.
Right. So the warehouses are, you know, they can't, as I said, you can't build it fast enough. So those are very strong. Apartments are very strong. The office market is trying to work with the tenants to see, okay, what is the office's future look like?
I've also heard that then in order to attract the people back into the offices, or if you're building a new one, and that actually has been happening, you'd better have the amenities. This had better be the dream office. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yes. The building that we recently opened at 448 North LaSalle in River North, we added and have a very nice rooftop amenity area with fire pits, grills. We've got a dog run area, and but more importantly, we've got a upgraded and very enhanced mechanical system for that brings in fresh air all the time. There's none of it's recirculated. It goes on a floor by floor, actually a space by space area, so that the fresh air is being brought into the building and goes out of the building on a very fast basis. So that way, you know, people know that they've got the fresh air, particularly in a post. You know, that's always been good to have, but particularly in a COVID era. Additionally, our building is Fitwell certified, so it's got we've got a fitness facility there. We've got enhancements to encourage people to walk, use the stairs. We've got a little meditation area, and there's a term that I heard recently, and it's called commute-worthy office building, in that you want to have a building that people will commute to because they're getting tired of sitting on their couches all day long.
Yeah.
And, it's like, okay, do I want to go to an older building that, you know, it low ceilings, no light, or do I want to be someplace that has some of the things where I can go outside, in River North, take advantage of the live, work, play type of things that are there.
Live, work, play. What do you make of that $500 million renovation of Willis Tower?
I think it's great. The folks at Gensler did a really nice job on it, and it's you know, it's always good to see people reinvesting in the building. And I think a lot of what EQ was trying to do was that, is make it to where people want to go there. They've got the wonderful amenities on the ground floor, and it's a much more welcoming building than it used to be.
Jay, do you think some of these office spaces are going to have to find another use, that we're not going to get back to 100%, and I don't know what's going to go there, but that something has to go there, and it won't be people in cubicles?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's an article today about a building on Michigan Avenue that's 70% vacant, and that they're potentially remarketing it as a residential play. There's a lot of buildings that don't... it's hard, you know. I would say, we'll just turn it into apartments or to a hotel, and it's, you know, with the depth, the low ceiling heights, it's easier said than done. But I do think, you know, some of the buildings in downtown Chicago, I think the city really needs to go out there and market it as office. We need people coming back into the downtown core area. And, you know, they should be reaching out to all the different government agencies, reach out to our congressional delegation to say, hey, are there offices that we can get to locate in downtown Chicago? Because, you know, even pre-COVID, we had BMO Harris moving out of the core Chicago area. They're near the post office. We've got Bank America moving over to Wacker Drive. So that you had these multi-million square foot vacancies that really need to get filled. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, just to get people back in the loop, but also to maintain the property tax values. Downtown Chicago generates a lot of property tax revenue that helps fund the schools.
Yeah, I don't know what's the first, the chicken or the egg, but we got to get people back downtown. People will come back downtown when there's more people back downtown and more activity downtown. But there's not going to be that until people come downtown. So at some point, we've got to tip the other way. And hopefully the weather will cooperate, the crime will subside, and that will happen. Javers is the founder of Midwest Property Group. You can find out more at MidwestPropertyGroup.net. We'll call again, Jay. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John. Take care.
The business news continues on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Peoples Gas has recorded record profits thanks to higher natural gas prices, but the utility says it will help thousands of Chicago area customers cover overdue heating bills. The company says it's wiping out balances for about 12,000 customers. Peoples Gas will use federal funding and state aid to help pay off the balances. The South and West Sides have been hit hardest. A Sun-Times analysis in April showed nearly half of households in some Chicago zip codes were behind on their gas bills. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And now the much-anticipated business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, I suppose I should start with an apology. But we got a big day coming up on the food calendar, John. In fact, I don't know why this is not an official Chicago holiday, but tomorrow is National Italian Beef Day. So to celebrate, I called a few of what are widely considered some of Chicago's favorites, and I will apologize in advance if your fave is not featured. But here we go, alphabetically.
My name is Christopher Pacelli, owner of L's Number One Italian Beef.
84 years and counting.
Well, it got started back in the 30s because of my Uncle Al. But my grandfather is the one that originally invented Italian beef back in 1917.
How about that? Okay, what makes a great Italian beef, Christopher?
Okay, so first it starts off with the meat. The meat is a top sirloin butt. And we have about 13 different spices that we use. And we use a natural garlic. We don't use a liquid garlic. And we cook that for 3.5 hours.
6 locations for Al's Beef. And he says if you go, you got to know how to stand.
When you eat it, you got to do the Italian stance. Arms on the counter and your feet back. And you dig your face into it. We give you a lot of napkins.
Next in the alphabet is Bona's, known for Italian beef since 1981. And Joe Bonavolanto III tells how Bona's does the beef.
So we use fresh garlic, salt, pepper, oregano. We sear it at a high temperature, and then we roast it for several hours after the searing process.
And the bread, Only Toronto's there.
It's a light, I would call it fluffy, but a little bit of crunch to this French bread that we use.
Bona began in Berwyn. There are 25 locations now around the area. Johnny's is next in line.
Well, Johnny's Beef's been around since 1961. Best beef sandwich you could find around.
Hey, a lot of people agree. Frank Stompanato is the owner of Johnny's Beef. What's the key to a great beef?
Thinly sliced beef, well-seasoned, on a good French bread, sweet peppers, hot peppers. You have to try it to believe it.
Elmwood Park at Arlington Heights for Johnny's, but wherever you get yours, it's hard to go wrong. Italian beef is a Chicago original. Or, as Christopher at Al's says,
you can't say original without saying Al. Original.
That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Some talk a little bit about the movie everybody's talking about with Amy Guth. You going to go see it?
Certainly. How can I not? You know, it's the continuation of such a classic from the 80s.
Yeah, we're talking about Top Gun, I guess, 2 now. Is that what it's called? Top Gun 2?
I think so. Top Gun Maverick, I think that's the name of it.
Yeah. What's the latest on that?
Well, so, of course, I keep an eye on Boeing and watch them very carefully. And so this interesting bit of reporting popped up from Bloomberg that I thought was interesting and worth chatting about a little bit. And so the military loaned the production, these FA-18 Hornets, for the Top Gun movie. And there's a couple of interesting details around that. So one of them is the studio paid about just a little over $11,000 per hour to use these fighter planes. So $11,374 per hour to use these fighter planes. And also Tom Cruise, who is famous, you know, for doing his own stunts and really putting himself at a lot of risk in order to get these stunts made and to make his movies. He really went through quite a bit to do this. He made sure everybody on the cast went through this training in these planes so they would know what it felt like. Now, of course, the Defense Department does not allow you to operate any of these planes. So the actors had to be with someone who is obviously trained, but the actors had to go through a pretty rigorous training process that was not only the minimum standard to be in the plane with the pilots, that includes, you know, how to eject in an emergency, what to do once you eject if you're over ocean, things like that, but also this whole other level that Cruise himself added to this training of really wanting to experience all the roles and all these things that you might do in the air. Of course, the Defense Department said, you know, this is not an accurate portrayal. This is not how these actors are not necessarily representing the people who really fly these planes. But it's kind of an interesting look in how studios operate when they're dealing with military equipment. But yeah, that price tag is pretty shocking. $11,374 an hour to use those planes. So when you see that film, kind of keep that number in mind and think about how many hours that might have taken to film all of that.
And also, I think you do have a sense of appreciation for Tom Cruise movies. They are pretty authentic to the degree they can be. He likes to do his own stunts. He likes to hang from plane wings. He likes to be in the cockpit. You'll actually, I guess, see that, huh?
Yeah, exactly right. So there are actual pilots flying, but they've made it look, actors were in there with them and made it look like those were the actors flying. But part of those rules is you cannot touch the controls. So they've had to be really creative about it.
Don't touch that button. Speaking of airplanes, talk to me about traffic at O'Hare.
Oh, boy. So, you know, Memorial Day weekend is usually kind of the kickoff for summer travel. The way things have gone the last couple of years, as you and I have talked about many times, there's a lot of eyes on air travel this weekend because airlines are really counting on a big revenue bump to kind of jumpstart summer travel. But they're also looking at a lot of logistics stuff. So John Pletz at Crain's Chicago Business did some reporting on this. Bloomberg has also been reporting on this. In particular, John Pletz took a look at O'Hare and Midway. So O'Hare is likely to be about 50% more crowded over this weekend. And they're measuring that from today through Tuesday than it was a year ago. And what that means in number terms is 1.4 million passengers are expected to go through O'Hare up until Tuesday, according to the Chicago Department of Aviation. Now, that's 47% higher than a year ago, but it's still about 18% below pre-pandemic levels of 2019. So it's really kind of a matter of, will airlines be ready to ramp up to those pre-pandemic levels, given that things have been slower over the last couple of years? Midway is a little bit different story. It's only going to be about 5%. 10% busier at Midway because they're so dependent on domestic and leisure travel anyway. That number has already kind of come back from them. So it'll be busier at Midway, but only by about 5% or so. But some of the headwinds facing airlines right now, you know, you have higher fuel prices. They have not put as many planes back in service yet that they had parked during the pandemic. So planes are going to be pretty full. And there's just a lot of, like, not a lot of wiggle room there. So I think a lot of eyes, a lot of industry watchers and a lot of organizations are kind of looking at this weekend as a big test for the travel industry, how it's going to go. You know, there's not a lot of margin for error. So any kind of hiccup, any kind of weather delay or computer glitch certainly will, you know, could really change things dramatically, and we'll see how it goes. But I think a lot of airlines are really kind of counting on this as a big test to see if they're ready for to kind of ramp up a little bit more for summer travel. So we'll have to take a look at that early next week and see how it all went numbers wise and just see if any of those headwinds were navigable or if they became hiccups.
Okay, Amy. Well, maybe we'll say to our listeners, if you're doing some flying this weekend through Monday, call us Tuesday. Let us know what the airport and airplane experience was like. That could be part of our follow-up here. That's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.